what is ISIS doing that Muhammad didn't do or wouldn't have approved of? That is actually unfortunately, not the easiest question to answer. And the example of Muhammad is, as just an exemplar of the faith, doesn't square very well with modern, cosmopolitan, secular, tolerant values. He was not a hippie who got crucified. He was not a meditator, an ascetic who sat cross-legged under a Bodhi tree. He was a warlord who did many of the things that you see members of ISIS doing, and that's why they can kind of paint by numbers and justify what they're doing with a very literalist and, as Majid would say, a vacuous reading of Islamic theology. And that's a very inconvenient fact which we have to confront head-on and find some way to disavow the intolerant readings of these passages in Scripture.
As I've said, I think that all religions are wrong in the same way, in that they privilege faith over reason, but they're not all equally bad in the same way all the time. I mean, if I'd been writing in the 1930s, I would certainly have said that the Roman Catholic Church was the most dangerous religion in the world because of its open alliance with fascism and anti-Semitism. The damage from that our culture has never recovered from and never will. But at the moment, it's very clear to me that the most toxic form that religion takes is the Islamic form. Horrible idea of wanting to end up with Sharia, with a religion-governed state, a state of religious law, and that the best means of getting there is jihad, holy war, and that Muslims have a special right to feel aggrieved enough to demand this, I think is an absolute obscene wickedness, and I think their religion is nonsense.
Hi everyone, this is Carlos Morales, and this is the Libertarian Atheist Podcast. Go to libertarian-atheist.com to check out the new site with all the new episodes, and if you haven't subscribed yet, please do so on iTunes, Stitcher, and YouTube. Today we'll be continuing our series on Islam. For those who haven't seen the first part, the Syrian refugees, Islam, and ISIS, what the media isn't telling you, I would suggest that you do that first. I feel that it is of utmost importance to discuss my intentions behind my work to educate individuals within atheist and libertarian circles, along with anyone else who's inclined to listen, on the topic of Islam. As is a necessary prerequisite to any conversation like this, no matter the facts I present, nothing I am saying can justify the 23,144 bombings dropped on Muslim countries done by the United States government in 2015. As well, as anyone who is familiar with my work would know, I do not believe that government will solve the central issues of dogmatism in our world. I have spoken about the inefficiencies and immorality inherent within the statist paradigm for years, and those problems don't magically go away when they're discussing the issues of global jihad. Lastly, what I've attempted to do with this series, which I decided to do after seeing the amount of ignorance surrounding this topic, is not an attempt at fear-mongering. Though fear can come about when facts are presented to an uncertain mind, it is not a guttural hatred that I am attempting to brew in others. Rather, it's about creating clarity and understanding on a fascinating topic that is growing in importance due to the influx of those who hold Islamic beliefs, immigrating into non-Muslim countries. The very fact that I've gotten such a pushback from libertarians and freethinkers by even bringing up the topic shows to me the importance of having this conversation. For we should not, as the left does so often, have a poverty of low expectations when discussing those of other cultures and customs. We must be willing to battle ideas based on their merit and not prevent ourselves from delving into controversy out of a fear of being called bigots. Many of us rightly bring up the social issues within our own cultures in an attempt to progress society forward, whether that be the rights of women to own property, men and women's ability to choose to have sex with people of their own gender if they'd like, equality among the races and the legal system, and so on. This push for tolerance, though, has led to an irrational position of tolerating intolerant beliefs and chastising those who are simply trying to speak the truth. A horrific case of this was when feminist groups petitioned to prevent Ayaan Hirsi Ali from being able to speak at a university. The fact that Ayaan takes a huge personal risk for being one of the premier spokeswomen for the rights of women in Muslim countries, specifically against the female genital mutilation that occurs there, highlights the hypocrisy of these activists. She made a film in 2004 entitled Submission, which is the English rendering of the word Islam. Islam means submission and not peace, which is what the film was focusing on. It led to the film's director, Van Gogh, being stabbed in the heart. A letter was stabbed through and affixed to his body by a dagger, which linked the murder to Van Gogh's film and his views regarding Islam. It was addressed to Ayaan Hirsi Ali and called for a jihad against kafir, kafir being a disbeliever or infidel, as well as a jihad against all of America, Europe, the Netherlands, and Hirsi Ali herself. This woman was called a bigot by feminist groups in America, but she dared to speak of the true oppression against females in other parts of the world. That Muslims are seen as an oppressed minority allowed these irrational feminist groups to attach themselves to a religious group, which is in every way antithetical to the aims of female liberation. They're all playing in the oppression Olympics. I fear that libertarians are acting similarly, which I will demonstrate by showing that Islam is not simply a religious movement, but also a political one, one that is very, very far from liberty and more closely related to outright fascism. I've seen meme after meme and heard and read ignorant debate after debate over the topic of Islam by libertarians who know nothing of the religion, its history, or its message. Rather, they simply take the position that as long as Muslims respect private property, then they are fine. Which there is some truth to. But beliefs matter. Beliefs lead to actions, and the beliefs and statements made within the Quran and Hadiths are not respectful of physical or mental liberation. Yes, there are libertarian Muslims. I know some, even though they make up an incredibly low percentage of Muslims as a whole. But that does not mean that the religion is not antithetical to the libertarian message. If you must go out of your way, which most Muslims and to a small extent Christians have to do, to not only ignore, but in some cases outright act in contradiction towards the horrendous tenets of the religion you subscribe to, you will constantly be in a state of cognitive dissonance. Within the West, we call this the religious moderate position. To a libertarian anarchist like myself, the religious moderate position is similar to the small state minarchist position, where someone acknowledges the non-aggression principle, acknowledges that coercion is illegitimate and unethical, yet they still fight for a small state. Their ideology never actually attacks the root problem. And this leads to a growth of the Leviathan that is the state rather than an abolishment of the central issue. The issue within minarchism is that the state inevitably grows to destroy individual sovereignty. And the issue with religious moderates is that they still believe faith is a virtue, which lends itself to radicalism by never chastising the problem itself, which is faith in dogma. You never actually fight against the problems within the Bible or the Quran if you're still stating they have all these great parts of them, if they're consistently contradicted, and the moral claims presented within those texts, the maybe one or two within the Quran, maybe a few within the New Testament, if you're stating that there is validity to them, but the reason, the justification for those moral principles is that there is a God in the sky who's telling you not to do those things, well, then the way by which you got the answer is incorrect, and that leads itself to irrationality in the future. Atheism is religious anarchism, where one takes the stand that dogma and faith are in opposition to reason and evidence. Dogma and religious faith are the enemy of peace and must be fought against through logic and not violence. If we as free thinkers want to push towards a more rational, reasonable, and less violent society, we cannot prevent bad ideas from being criticized simply because some people who hold those bad ideas are being oppressed in some areas. Which is a large reason why Islam has not been criticized in the media in as strong as ways Christianity has been. There's a fetishization of the oppressed that occurs, which lays the responsibility and blame of atrocious actions done by the oppressed on the oppressors. But Islam presents a unique and more complex problem than simply, as everyone likes to say, blowback. There is an insistence that suicide bombers, terrorists, jihadists come from poor and uneducated homes, which, while often stated, doesn't hold any truth under scrutiny. In fact, there's not a higher chance of a suicide bomber being educated or uneducated, poor or middle income, there's one similarity between them, that they hold Allah as their God. You see, there are people everywhere in the world in terrible situations, but most of them don't force women to wear specific clothing. They don't kill people for leaving their religion. They don't commit clitorectomies on a constant basis against little girls. They don't strap suicide bombs in their chest or the host of other insane actions done in the name of Allah. Do all Muslims enforce or condone every action or belief I just described? Absolutely not, and I'm thankful of that. Though, as I have outlined in my last episodes in the series, a shocking proportion of Muslims across the world justify things like suicide bombings. And why is this? It's because the religion justifies the actions of groups like ISIS in an intricate detail. And those who state that it does not are either ignorant or lying to themselves and others. Now, people may contest that Muslims are only justified in violence in some form of self-defense. But, as is shown in the later chapters of the Quran and throughout the history of Islam, any prior offense to any Muslim anywhere by any group can be used to justify the deaths of everyone in that group. The Hadith, which recounts the sayings and actions of the Prophet, breaks down the merits of this killing and sacrificing repeatedly. And before I go too far into that, I need to discuss a statement that is made by liberals who apparently never read the Quran and Islamic apologists, which is that the word jihad simply means a philosophical inner struggle that has nothing to do with violence. Any reading of the Quran shows quite quickly that the outer struggle, the struggle to conquer, use violence and take over, is much more abundant. For instance, the Quran specifically exempts the disabled and elderly from jihad, Surah 495, which would make no sense if the word is being used merely within the context of spiritual struggle. It is also unclear why Muhammad and the Quran would use graphic language such as smiting fingers and heads from the hands and the necks of unbelievers if he were speaking merely of character development. The most reliable of all hadith collections is that of Bukhari. Within it, jihad is mentioned over 200 times in reference to the words of Muhammad, and nearly everyone carries a clear connotation to holy war, with only a handful of possible exceptions, namely dealing with a woman's supporting role during the time of holy war. Quote, jihad is your duty under any ruler, be godly or wicked. A single endeavor of fighting in Allah's cause in the forenoon or in the afternoon is better than the world and whatever is in it. A day and a night fighting on the frontier is better than a month of fasting and prayer. Nobody who dies and finds good from Allah in the hereafter would wish to come back to this world even if he were given the whole world and whatever is in it. Except the martyr, on seeing the superiority of martyrdom, would like to come back to the world and get killed again in Allah's cause. He who dies without having taken part in a campaign dies in a kind of unbelief. Paradise is in the shadow of swords. No part of that statement represents a rational and logical worldview. And though there may be apologist reaction to simply say context, 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 I will thoroughly demonstrate that when context is added, those words are even more horrifying. There's a sort of twisted obsession and love for death throughout the Quran, and a disdain for the here and now which lends itself to the moniker Mediterranean Death Cult. This obsession with martyrdom and the glory given to those who die for their belief is why fighting this religion through violence has failed in such a tremendous way. Let it be known that whatever I say here is not to absolve the violent hostility towards Muslims expressed by neo-reactionaries. These neo-reactionaries want to steal from others through taxation, under the threat of death to arm a group of soldiers who will then inflict death on others, many of whom who have done no wrong, will and has only led to an increase in jihadism. This has been shown in the wars of Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, and so on. But to callously look away from the horrendous aspects of Islamic culture, or moreover, suggest that it has nothing to do with Islam, to fight against the right wing is preposterous, dangerous, and severely lacking in any integrity whatsoever. You can, in fact, be against Western governmental policies and bigoted fascistic religious governmental policies in Eastern countries as well. In fact, The only way to be ethically consistent and honest is to do so. What we are discussing here is a belief system and not a race of people. And no belief system in the world is free from scrutiny. I've spent damn near a decade debating, discussing, and dissecting Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. From public lectures and academic debates to writings, radio, TV shows, Fox News, performance arts, podcasts. And I have done so due to the bigoted, hateful, and irrational values within all of those belief systems. Most liberal white Americans know the hateful side of Christianity. But it is time for Islam to have the light of reason shed upon it. So, we'll begin by discussing the history of Muhammad. For the sake of clarity, the Quran is a collection of words that Muhammad attributed to Allah. The Hadith is a collection of narrations of the life and deeds of Muhammad. The Sirah is his recorded biography. The Sunnah is said to be Muhammad's way of life, on which Islamic law, Sharia, is based. And I'll put this out here also. There is a good chance that I will butcher some of the Arabic names that I'll be talking about within this presentation. I do apologize for it. Just cut me a little bit of slack if you could. Muhammad was born in Mecca in 570. In 576, he's orphaned upon the death of his mother. In 595, he marries Khadija, an older, wealthy woman. And in 610, at the age of 40, he gets his first message from an angel while spending time in a cave. According to the divine message, Muhammad is, quote, an excellent pattern of conduct, Surah 33:21. And other individuals should show him special privilege as well as unwavering obedience, Surah 4:80. Soon enough, this illiterate Arab charismatic salesman started influencing small groups of people into believing in his self-referential and strong revelations by promising them great rewards in heaven, which amounted to milk, honey, and according to some translations, a good amount of sex in the afterlife, an eternal, fiery damnation for those that don't believe in his divine message. For a bit of context, Muhammad was born in the Arabian Peninsula, an oppressively hot and then annoyingly cold area with rocky terrain, with little technological or philosophical achievement and terrible vegetation. Though you might imagine that the whole of the world was this awful at this time, areas north in the Middle East and Europe were transitioning from the Roman to Byzantine Empire and were developing amazing things like roads, irrigation canals, aqueducts, and a culture that enjoyed taking part in philosophical discourse and theater. In comparison to the harsh and hostile world that the Arabians lived in, with warring tribes and short lifespans, this appeared utopic. This may be why Islam developed such a hostility towards the things that make life enjoyable, namely music and art. The terrible climate protected much of the peninsula from conquest, as well as cultural influence. And while a renaissance of knowledge was booming in much of the rest of the world, the Arabs were fighting over goats. The cultures were very tribalistic and filled with a plethora of pagan religious traditions. Within Muhammad's Quraysh tribes, they worshipped a moon god called Allah. But there were other gods who were recognized as well. In fact, much of Mecca was tolerant towards other religions, as long as there remained a respect for pluralism within those branches of faith. This ended shortly after Muhammad gained power. The Islamic religion has a mixture of pagan practices, as well as aspects taken from Christianity and Judaism, which Muhammad most likely gathered from cults within the Palestinian region now known as Syria. Syria, prior to the influx and conquest by Muslims later, was a hub for Christianity. When Muhammad got to the age of around 25, he met and married a wealthy widow named Khadija, and his wife's trading business nurtured his persuasion ability, allowed him to travel and live a semi-comfortable life compared to some of his peers. He could afford to have time for contemplation and suffer from the most common malady of modernity, a lack of meaning in life. Thankfully, though, he found that meaning when an angel named Gabriel visited him. According to Islamic tradition, the archangel Gabriel appeared before him in the year 610 current era and said, "Read," upon which he replied, "I am unable to read." Thereupon the angel got hold of him and embraced him heavily. This happened two more times, after which the angel commanded Muhammad to recite the following verses. "Proclaim, in the name of thy Lord and Cherisher, who created man out of a mere clot of congealed blood, proclaim, and thy Lord is most bountiful, who taught the use of the pen, taught man that which he knew not. Surah 96:1-5. Muhammad continued to get a series of revelations until he died 23 years later. At this point, with the support of his wife, Muhammad declared himself a prophet under the same lineage as Abraham and Jesus, and began preaching a new religion. His original teachings were filled with compromises to the predominant beliefs of many of the community elders, combining 300 of their idols under the name of Allah, and a whole amalgamation of Judeo-Christianity and pagan traditions. Of course, he modified them to have the common theme, believe in the messenger Muhammad, or suffer consequences. Now, according to Islamic myth, Muhammad was quickly persecuted by Meccans, but a quick look at the records shows that's not completely true. According to early Islamic historians, the Meccans were tolerant towards polytheists, Jews, Christians, and pagans. The so-called persecution began when Muhammad began to break the Meccan tradition and began cursing other religions. According to early historian Ibn Ishaq, who is Prophet Muhammad's earliest and most important biographer, who collected all the oral information about the Prophet, and will be cited greatly throughout this presentation, this is how the contention began. Quote, when the apostle openly displayed Islam as Allah ordered him, his people did not withdraw or turn against him, so far as I have heard, until he spoke disparagingly of their gods. When he did that, they took great offense and resolved unanimously to treat him as an enemy. The Meccans said they had never known anything like the trouble they had endured from this fellow. He declared their mode of life foolish, insulted their forefathers, reviled their religion, divided the community, and cursed their gods. Unquote. Not only was this an insult to the people and their traditions, but it also threatened the local economy, which depended on the annual pilgrimage. Still, they were so eager to live at peace that they offered Muhammad money if he would stop stirring up trouble. Again, from Ibn. They decided to send for Muhammad and to negotiate and argue with him. When he came and sat down with them, they explained that they had sent for him in order that they could talk together. No Arab had ever treated his tribe as Muhammad had treated them, and they repeated the charges. If it was money he wanted, they'd make him the richest of them all. If it was honor, he should be their prince. If it was sovereignty, they would make him king. Hisham 188. What followed would be known by Muslim lore as the Satanic Verses. In an attempt to reconcile the issues, Muhammad contradicted his earlier statements and began to recognize the other gods, and the Meccans rejoiced. Soon, though, his believers started losing faith in him, due in part because the religion was founded on the antithesis of plurality. Muhammad then recanted his statements when believers started losing faith in him. After that, Muhammad said that Satan was actually speaking through him at the time, and that Satan made him be tolerant for just a moment, from Surah 22:52. And we did not send before you any messenger or prophet, except that when he spoke or recited, Satan threw into it some misunderstanding. But Allah abolishes that which Satan throws in. Then Allah makes precise his verses, and Allah is knowing and wise. Unquote. Though many Muslims claim that there was a mass persecution, the earliest biographers, namely Ibn and al-Tabari, recorded only one death of a Muslim during that period, an old lady who died from stress. The Muslims were the first to resort to physical violence, when Sa'id bin Abu picked up a camel's jawbone and struck a local polytheist who was, quote, rudely interrupting his group of praying Muslims. This was the first blood to be shed in Islam. Newer converts to the religion were quite violent. Quote, when he got to the mosque, Hamza saw Abu sitting among the people and went up to him until he stood over them, when he lifted up his bow and struck him a violent blow with it, saying, will you insult me when I follow his religion and say what he says? Hit me back if you can. Now, after the death of Muhammad's uncle in 619, he no longer had a protector to contest the Meccan leadership. The Meccans yet again attempted to make an offer of peace, but Muhammad wouldn't have it. Muhammad then searched for a political alliance, which led to him to make a deal with the people of Medina to go to war against the Meccans. Due to a rational fear of impeding increased violence and possible war, the Meccans' level of tolerance lowered quite quickly. This must be restated. The Muslims were the first to declare war. The year that Muhammad fled Mecca from Medina was 622, which marks the beginning of the Muslim calendar. Once Muhammad left and was rejected by his town and tribe, his message grew more intolerant and violent, which is reflected within the Quran. What needs to be noted here is the term abrogation. Abrogation, or tasfir, essentially means that whenever a new verse contradicts an old verse, the new verse is that which should be followed. So, the more peaceful Meccan Muhammad's teachings are abrogated, which means canceled or obliterated, for the more tyrannical verses that follow, from Surah 16:101. When we substitute one revelation for another, and Allah knows best what He reveals in stages, they say, "Thou art but a forger." But most of them understand not. Another verse, 13:39, states, "Allah doth blot out or confirm what He pleaseth." This allowed for an incredibly gracious loophole that Muhammad used constantly. Moving on. By the time Muhammad gets to Medina, we get the more violent verses. From Surah 2:6, "As for the disbelievers, whether thou warn them or thou warn them not, it is all one for them. They believe not. Allah hath sealed their hearing and their hearts, and on their eyes there is a covering. Theirs will be an awful doom." Surah 2191. "And kill them wherever you find them, and turn them out from where they have turned you out. And al-fitna, disbelief or unrest, is worse than killing. But if they desist, then lo, Allah is forgiving and merciful. And fight them until there is no more disbelief and worshipping of others along with Allah. And worship is for Allah alone. But if they cease, let there be no transgression, except against the polytheists and wrongdoers." The verse to this, 190, refers to fighting the cause of Allah those who fight you, leading some to believe that the entire passage refers to a defensive war in which Muslims are defending their homes and families. But within the historical context, the passage is not about defensive warfare. Muhammad and his followers had just relocated to Medina and were not under offensive attack by the Meccans. The verses actually urge offensive warfare. Muslims are told to drive Meccans out of Mecca, which they accomplish later on. Verse 190 actually means to fight those who offer resistance to Allah's rule, i.e. Islamic conquest. The use of the word persecution by some Muslim translators is a lie. The actual Arabic word for persecution, ittihad, and oppression, a variation of zlm, do not appear in the verse. The word that was actually used, fitna, means disbelief, or the disorder that resulted from unbelief or temptation. This is what is meant in context, since the violence is explicitly commissioned until religion is for Allah, i.e. unbelievers desist in their unbelief. Here's a few more quotes. Surah 2:216. "Fighting is prescribed for you, and ye dislike it, but it is possible that ye dislike a thing which is good for you, and that ye love a thing which is bad for you. But Allah knoweth, and ye know not." Surah 3:56. "As those who reject faith, I will punish them with terrible agony in this world and the hereafter, nor will they have anyone to help." Surah 3:151. "Soon shall we cast terror into the hearts of the unbelievers, for that they joined companions with Allah for which He had sent no authority." Now let's get back to the history. At this point, Muhammad and his followers have been exiled from Mecca. To gain control and power within the region, Muhammad directed his followers to begin raiding Meccan caravans during the holy months, so that the victims wouldn't expect it. Not only would they steal, but they also got to taking slaves. He justified this through very convenient revelations from Allah. Let's take a look at a particular accusation documented once again by historian Eben. A Muslim raider who had shaved his head looked down on them, the Meccan caravan. And when they saw him, they felt safe and said, "They are pilgrims. You have nothing to fear from them." The shaved head caused the Muslims to look like pilgrims rather than raiders, which instilled a false sense of security in the drivers. The Muslim raiders encouraged each other and decided to kill as many as they could of them and take what they had. Waqid shot Amir bin al-Hadrami with an arrow and killed him. According to Ibn Kathir, a highly influential Sunni scholar, the Muslims living in Mecca did not dispute that their brethren in Medina had killed, captured, and stolen from the Quraysh, but they were reluctant to accept that this had been occurring during the sacred months. At this point, Muhammad came up with a very well-timed revelation from Allah that gave retroactive permission for the raid on a holy month, along with the stealing of goods from people who were not harming them. Surah 2:217. They ask you concerning the sacred month about fighting in it. Say, fighting in it is a grave matter, and hindering men from Allah's way and denying Him and hindering men from the sacred mosque and turning its people out of it are still graver with Allah, and persecution is graver than slaughter. So, unlike those who incorrectly justify this murder, the Quran does not say that the Meccans were guilty of killing actual Muslims. If that were the case, the justification could be made, but rather that the Meccans were persecuting them. But by persecute, they mean preventing them from entering a sacred mosque. You don't let me go to your mosque, therefore I am justified in murdering a whole group of you, many of you who have nothing to do with me not being allowed to get into that mosque. That's not self-defense. At this point, the Meccans, aggravation and desperation led them to send their army to protect their caravans from these Muslims, who were gaining an affinity for looting and pillaging. This led to the Battle of Badr, where afterwards Muhammad killed hostages. According to Ibn, after the battle, defenseless Meccans were chopped up. One case of this concerns Abu Jahl, who was laying defenseless on the ground. Mawadi passed Abu Jahl as he lay there helpless, and smawed him until he left him at his last gasp. Another Muslim named Abdullah then came by and put his foot on Abu Jahl's neck and taunted him before decapitating him. Speaking as Abdullah, "Then I cut off his head and brought it to the apostle, saying, 'This is the head of the enemy of Allah, Abu Jahl.' I threw his head before the apostle, and he, Muhammad, gave thanks to Allah." Not only did the Prophet of Islam praise them for the slaughter, he also ordered the death of another captive brought before him. Uqbah bin Abu pled for his life. When the apostle ordered him to be killed, Uqbah said, "But who will look after my children, O Muhammad?" Muhammad's reply, "Hell." The man was put to death. Though Islamic apologists contend that Islam does not justify the killing of captives, that's simply a lie. Interestingly, it appears that Muhammad regretted not killing all of his captives, instead of ransoming a few. In Surah 867, it is revealed in the aftermath of Badr, "It is not for any prophet to have captives until he hath made slaughter in the land." The Prophet of Islam went on to execute many other captives, most notoriously the 800 men and boys taken prisoner at Khorezah. His men also brutally murdered an elderly woman named Kirfa after taking her prisoner following a raid on the tribe of Banu Fazara. According to Al-Tabari, she was killed by putting a rope to her two legs and the two camels and driving them until they rent her in two. Afterwards, out of Muhammad's great mercy, he took one of the women's daughters and doled it out to the Muslim killers. After the Battle of Badr, a consolidation of power occurred when Muhammad worked to divide and conquer the local Jewish tribes within Medina. These tribes weren't friendly with one another, and Muhammad used that to his advantage. He did this at first by appeasing some of the Jews and Christians in the area, stating that they could reach salvation with their own faith. He had his followers pray towards Jerusalem rather than Mecca. But issues arose in part due to Jewish leaders having issues with Muhammad's knowledge of the Torah. Namely, he used the Torah to justify his prophethood, which the Jews stated was contradicted from the established narrative or revelation within the Torah. You'll find stories sprinkled within the Quran that discuss the Old and New Testament, but there are contradictions between the stories that are described in the Quran and the way they're described in the Torah and the New Testament. Essentially, Muhammad kind of told the drunk history version of biblical stories with a megalomania twist. The Quran added in stories about Jesus that claims he was a slave to Allah while he was a baby, as in a baby in a cradle is talking. Let's go to the Quran, Surah 19:29. So she pointed to him, Jesus. They said, "How can we speak to one who is in the cradle of a child?" Jesus, baby Jesus, said, Indeed, I am he, the servant of Allah. He has given me the scripture and made me a prophet, and he has made me blessed wherever I am, and has enjoined upon me prayer and zakah as long as I remain alive, and made me dutiful to my mother, and he has not made me a wretched tyrant. And peace is on me the day I was born, and the day I will die, and the day I am raised alive. This is Jesus, the son of Mary, the word of truth about which they are in dispute. Now, this little addition isn't so bad to the canon, but the follow-up part in this story is where things get a bit bothersome for Christians. Surah 19:35. It is not befitting for Allah to take a son, exalted is he. When he decrees an affair, he only say to it, be, and it is. Did you see that addition there? Jesus is not the son of God. So little Jesus then states, and indeed, Allah is my Lord and your Lord. So worship him. That is a straight path. Another translation states from that quote, it befitteth not the majesty of Allah that he should take a son unto himself. Now it follows up with, the sects among them differ, but woe unto the disbelievers from the meeting of an awful day. End quote. So Jesus isn't the son of God. And though some sects may disagree with that statement, for instance, Christians, they are all going to hell. Hell, known as Jahannam, in the Quran and Hadiths, is mentioned much more often in the Quran than in the Bible, with very strong descriptions, including the burning of skin, only for skin to be replaced for reburning, garments of fire to be worn and boiling water that will scald the skin, and internal organs and faces. Faces on fire, lips burnt off, backs on fire, from side to side. Faces dragged along fire, bound in yokes, then dragged through boiling water and fire, and wearing a pair of sandals on fire that will boil your brain. Hell is said to be filled with venomous snakes, scorpions, the pain from whose venom will last 40 years. I'm not sure if the snakes are on fire or not, but it seems like everything else is on fire. These are some of the most truly catastrophic, violent ways to be tortured. And it would take the most masochistic of individual to dream up these different forms of violent treatment. The thing, though, is, hell is not relegated to those who hold sex slaves, kill unbelievers, pillagers, or rapists, as long as they're fighting for Allah and his prophet. No, the fiery eternal damnation is for polytheists, those who take Jesus as the son of God, those who leave Islam, and quite oddly, picture makers. This is discussed in Al-Bukhari. The people who will receive the severest punishment from Allah will be the picture makers. Regarding picture makers, in Islam, there is a prescription against the creation of images of sentient beings. The most absolute prescription is of images of God in Islam, followed by the depictions of Muhammad, and then Islamic prophets and the relatives of Muhammad. But the depiction of all humans and non-human animals is discouraged in the Hadith and by the long tradition of Islamic authorities, especially those of the Sunni variety. This is why the Taliban movement in Afghanistan banned photography and destroyed non-Muslim artifacts, especially carvings and statues such as the Buddhas of Bamiyan, on the grounds that the artifacts are idolatrous or shirk. Moreover, this view had a bright light shined upon it when Danish cartoonist drew Muhammad and you had a global protest. Danish Prime Minister Anders described the controversy as Denmark's worst international relations incident since the Second World War, all for drawing a cartoon. If you draw Muhammad, not only should he be murdered, but you will also burn in a lake of fire for eternity. Getting back to the mentions of the New Testament and the Quran, in regards to Mary, there's an entire chapter dedicated to her, and she's the only woman mentioned by name in the Quran. Though this may appear cynical on my part and the part of many scholars, this appears to be a political move on the part of Muhammad to give his ideology an ancient backing that merges with the current cultures of the time to obfuscate the irrationality of it all. Joseph Smith later did the same thing with Mormonism. This did not win many converts within the Jewish population at the time. They found his lack of knowledge regarding the Torah and his misinterpretations and additions to stories very troubling. And yet another fascinating, convenient revelation from Allah. Muhammad was told that the Jews had deliberately corrupted their own text to hide the evidence of his own prophethood. With his ability for sophistry, mixed in with a message of grave importance and apocalyptic doom that mirrors that of many cults before and after it, Muhammad was able to convert many Arab polytheists to Islam. When he gained enough of a following, his intentions were made more clear. Islam would soon be imposed by force. While we were in the mosque, the Prophet came out and said, "Let us go to the Jews." We went out till we reached Bat ul-Mudras. He said to them, "If you embrace Islam, you will be safe. You know that the earth belongs to Allah and His Apostle, and I want to expel you from this land. So if anyone amongst you owns a property, he is permitted to sell it. Otherwise, you should know that the earth belongs to Allah and His Apostle." Bukhari 53:392. Apologists for Islam will contend that Muhammad did not believe in forcing others to believe in Islam. In an early verse of the Quran, it states, "Let there be no compulsion of religion," which sounds great, but actions like this and many others disprove that claim. As a result of this threat of a course of takeover of the land and the calling of the expelling of Jews off their own homesteaded area, hostilities, not surprisingly, began to emerge. But there needed to be some form of pretext to completely justify outright slaughter of the Jewish population, lest Muhammad come off as some kind of brutal savage. Thankfully, he found that justification, when according to a Muslim, someone within the Jewish tribe, the Kanuka, had apparently harassed a Muslim woman. The harasser, a guy who's simply harassing a woman, was then murdered. Fair enough. But then that was considered enough of a justification for driving a whole tribe of people off their land and murdering a fair amount of them. The Kanuka were forced into exile and the Muslims took their possession of property, making it their own. Muhammad personally reserved a fifth of the ill-gotten gains for himself. Things became even more troubling after this. A number of Muslims began attacking prominent Jews on Muhammad's order, which included one of the leaders of another Jewish tribe. Kaib was a poet whose writings were considered offensive to Muslims, and it was offensive to Muslims. He made jokes about having sex with Muhammad's wives. According to Ibn Ishaq, Muhammad called upon his followers to kill Kaib because he composed amatory verses of an insulting nature about the Muslim women. According to Norman Stillman, author of The Jews of Arab Lands, a History and Sourcebook, Muhammad was acting within the norms of the Arab society of that period, which demanded retaliation for any slight to a group's honor. Muhammad was convinced that the Banu Nadir were going to murder him in retaliation, and they too were banished and had their property taken, as discussed within the Quran, The Gather. "And what Allah gave as booty to His messenger Muhammad from them, for which he made no expedition with either cavalry or camelry. But Allah gives power to His messengers over whomsoever He wills, and Allah is able to do all things. What Allah gave as booty to His messenger Muhammad from the people of the townships, it is for Allah. And whatsoever the messenger gives you, take it. And whatsoever he forbids of you, abstain from it, and fear Allah. In truth, Allah is severe in punishment." Now, I obviously don't believe in Allah, but Muhammad was certainly severe in punishment and was willing to deceive in order to take over the area. The last surviving contingent of the Banu Nadir was tricked to leave their fortress when a promise of peace talks were brought up. Muhammad sent a group of 30 armed men to the area. Again, I'm using Ibn for the source, which guaranteed a safe passage to meet with Muhammad. When they left the area, they were slaughtered while they were unarmed, and the area was taken over. Now understand, of course I know that war is brutal. Conquering is brutal, and many horrendous acts were committed during that time. Muhammad was using many of the tactics that brutal men and conquerors at the time would do to conquer, which speaks to him being a human and not a divinely inspired, peaceful, and righteous man. This brings us up to the terrible incident, which has been referred to as the Khorezai Massacre. The Khorezai were the last remaining Jewish tribe in Medina that Muhammad hasn't kicked out yet. After the Battle of the Trench in 627, it is claimed by some Muslims that the Khorezai violated the treaty with Muhammad by aligning themselves with attacking tribes from Mecca. This may have been the case, though it is certainly understandable to try and defend yourself from a group that has slaughtered two different Jewish groups in the surrounding area. According to Eben, Muhammad was told by the angel Gabriel to attack the Khorezai. The siege lasted 25 days. After the Khorezai morale waned, Kaib Ibn Asad, chief of the Khorezai, suggested three alternative ways out of their predicament. Embrace Islam, kill their own children and women, then rush out for a charge to either win or die, or make a surprise attack on the Sabbath. The Banu Khorezai accepted none of these alternatives. Instead, they asked to confer with Abu Lababa, one of their allies from the Oz. According to Eben, Abu felt pity for the women and children of the tribe who were crying, and when asked whether the Khorezai should surrender to Muhammad, advised them to do so. However, he also made a sign with his hand towards his throat, indicating that their fate at the hands of the Prophet would be slaughter. The next morning, the Banu Khorezai surrendered, and the Muslims seized their stronghold and their stores. After the surrender, a surrender to a group that they did not initially attack but were acting defensively towards, Muhammad decided that he had spared enough Jews and it was time for executions. Muhammad ordered every boy that had reached the age of puberty to be executed. A group of Muslims dug up a trench, had each one of them kneel and took a blade and cut off every one of their heads. The total estimate dead is between 700 and 900 men and boys after the surrender. The surviving children became slaves to the Muslims, while the widows became sex slaves. Let's take a look at one of the accounts. Then the apostle divided their property, wives and children of Banu Khorezai, among the Muslims, and he made known of that day the shares of horses and men, and took out a fifth. A horseman got three shares, two for the horse and one for his rider. A man without a horse got one share. On the day of Banu Khorezai, there were 36 horses. It was the first booty on which lots were cast and a fifth was taken. This remained the custom thereafter on all raids. Then the apostle sent Sa'id bin Zaid al-Ansari, brother of bin Abdul Ashal, with some of the captive women of the Banu Khorezai to Najd, and he sold them for horses and weapons. Muhammad was always particularly brutal with the wives and slaves. He apparently had no problem having the soldiers rape the wives of male enemies while their husbands were still alive, as explained in the Hadith. They met their enemy and fought with them. They defeated them and took them captives. Some of the companions of the Apostle of Allah, may peace be upon him, were reluctant to have intercourse with the female captives in their presence of their husband, who were unbelievers. So Allah, the Exalted, set down the Quranic verse, Surah 4:24, "And all married women are forbidden unto you, except the captives whom your right hand possesses." Right-hand possession in this context is those who you have enslaved. So Allah told them not to be reluctant to rape the unbelieving women in front of their husbands, for now they own them. So because they chose not to convert, Muhammad raped women in front of their husbands, cut off the husbands' heads afterwards, killed 12-year-old boys, took 8-year-olds as slaves, and sold off the women as sex slaves for horses. If you see a connection between actions like this and those carried out by the Taliban and ISIS, then you're starting to understand their actions are not a perversion of Islam, but rather a fulfillment of it. Slavery as a conversion tactic has been used throughout the history of Islam. A man can marry four wives and then have an unlimited number of sex slaves, the only rule being that the offspring automatically become Muslim. The sexual practices of Muhammad himself, especially in regard to the ages of some of his partners, are outrageous by even the standards of the time. The man married a girl at the age of 6 and had sex with her at the age of 9. Though I've heard apologists have the gall to state that this is a categorical lie, the hadith is pretty damn clear. That the Prophet married her when she was 6 years old, and he consummated his marriage when she was 9 years old, and then she remained with him for 9 years until his death. We have to discuss this. If Muhammad is the model by which Muslims should act, if he, as is stated in the Quran, is a beautiful pattern of conduct, whose hope is in Allah, and an exalted standard of character, then you cannot look at shock when you see Muslim men taking child wives. It is justified within their religion. Muhammad's actions, which are becoming increasingly violent, could be justified thusly. Allah's apostle said, "Whoever obeys me will enter paradise, and whoever disobeys me will not enter it." Bukhari 92:384. To help calm things down for a moment between the Meccans, so that Muhammad could absorb more money through conquests, which will be described in a second, Muhammad signed the Treaty of Hudaybiyah. It was an agreement between Muhammad, representing the state of Medina, and the remaining Quraysh tribe of Mecca. The signing was controversial to some of the Muslim group, in part because Muhammad was not referenced as a messenger of God. There are other stipulations regarding the movement of different parties between the two areas. Nevertheless, Muhammad thought of it as a win. Quote, "Understand truth, we have granted thee a manifest victory." He also promised much spoils in the near future, and he sent down peace of reassurance on them, and hath rewarded them with a near victory, and much booty that they will capture. Muhammad made good on that promise during his next conquest. To extend his takeover, Muhammad set his sights on Khaybar, a small farming village inhabited by Jews around 100 miles outside of Medina. They had pioneered the cultivation of the oasis and made their money growing date palm trees, as well as through commerce and craftsmanship, which led them to become a considerably wealthy fortress town. The area was divided into three regions by natural separations, including desert, lava drifts, and swamps. After the Jewish Banu Nadir had been exiled from the area, some of the leaders moved to areas in Khaybar. Muhammad began to believe, through divine revelation, that these Jews would conspire to have them killed. To be fair, I wouldn't blame them given the circumstances. To begin his attack against these people, who have now been exiled into a completely different territory, he sent disguised guests to the homes of the leaders of the Banu Nadir. They lied to them to get into the home, and then executed these people who had done no wrong. Soon after, the Muslims attacked house after house, seizing their property, and simply slaughtering people, as outlined by Eben. "We met the workers of Khaybar, coming out in the morning with their spades and baskets. When they saw the apostle and the army, they cried, 'Muhammad with his force,' and turned tail and fled. The apostle seized the property piece by piece." The people of Khaybar were not attacking Muhammad. They were farming their land with shovels and buckets, not even knowing that they were supposed to be at war. When the apostle raided the people, he waited until the morning. If he heard a call to prayer, he held back. If he did not hear it, he attacked. "We came to Khaybar by night, and the apostle passed the night there. And when morning came, he did not hear the call to prayer. So he rode, and we rode with him." During the siege, there was questions presented to Muhammad by his own men about why they were going to slaughter and take over this area. Ali, one of Muhammad's son-in-laws, questioned Muhammad himself. Allah's messenger called Ali and said, "Proceed on and do not look about until Allah grants your victory." And Ali went a bit and then halted and did not look about and then said in a loud voice, "Allah's messenger, on what issue should I fight with the people?" Thereupon the Prophet said, "Fight with them until they bear testimony to the fact there is no God but Allah and Muhammad is his messenger." During the siege, Muhammad went from one settlement to another and quickly took over due to a lack of coordinating fighting forces. Crazy that a group of Jewish farmers weren't able to coordinate quickly to fight off a horde of well-trained and merciless Muslims who caught them off guard. After the victory over the farm town, Muhammad felt as if these Jews were not being upfront regarding the town's wealth, which Muhammad was looking to plunder. In a rather horrendous case, Muhammad chose to torture a man by kindling a fire on his chest, from Ibn Ishaq, Hisham 7:64. When he, Muhammad, asked him about the rest, he refused to produce it, so the apostle gave orders to Al-Zubari, "Torture him until you extract what is his." So he kindled a fire with flint and steel on his chest until he was nearly dead. Then the apostle delivered to him to Muhammad bin Maslama, and he struck off his head. Afterward, Muhammad then took the man's now widowed wife as his own. Muhammad, out of a concern that Khaybar would no longer send agricultural produce to the Hejaz, signed an agreement to have the Jews continue to work for him, while also being granted half their crops. This was a time when half your crops could easily mean life or death, and they were essentially made slaves. Quote, "Fight those who do not believe in Allah, nor in the latter day, nor do they prohibit what Allah and His messengers have prohibited, nor follow the religion of truth out of those who have been given the book, until they pay the tax in acknowledgement of superiority, and they are in a state of subjugation." Surah 9:29. This, by the way, is considered a peaceful negotiation by Muslim apologists. Take over a town, light some people on fire, take women as sex slaves, and then enslave them. At this point, the relations between Meccans and Medinas were getting even worse. After the signing of the treaty, two feuding tribes aligned themselves on the opposite sides of the Meccan-Muslim divide. On the Meccan side, the Banu Bakr had already suffered multiple raids, rapes, and murders against the tribes who had aligned with the Medinas, the Kuza. Let me explain. Before the agreement was made, the Kuzas murdered members of the Banu Bakr. In response, a member of the Banu Bakr murders members of the Kuzas, and the Kuzas respond yet again. At this point, the Kuzas join with the Muslims, and the Banu Bakr, who are aligned with the Meccans, then murder another one of the Kuzas. This could be considered the Meccans breaking the treaty first, which justifies Muhammad's takeover of Mecca. That is, except for the fact that Muhammad had already broken the treaty. Part of the treaty, which was agreed upon, stated that if a Muslim flees to Medina, they must be returned. Not shortly after the agreement was made, a group of Meccans fled towards Medina. Rather than make good on the agreement, Muhammad refused to send back not the men, but the women, and came up with a justification for it. Surah 60:10. O you who believe, when believing women come to you as immigrants, examine them. Allah knows best as to their faith. Then if you ascertain that they are true believers, send them not back to the disbelievers. They are not lawful wives for the disbelievers, nor are the disbelievers lawful husbands for them. This is the judgment of Allah. He judges between you, and Allah is all-knowing, all-wise. Now, this could be seen as Muhammad being a good-hearted man, but it is interesting that it was only the women that he kept, and not the husbands of the women. Also, honestly, knowing the history of Muhammad's sexual conquests, it's not hard to believe that he was using Allah yet again to justify his lusts. It was after this that the Banu killed a member of the Kuza. Muhammad broke the treaty first, and yet used the tribal dispute to justify the complete violent conquest of Mecca. The Meccan leader Abu Sufyan offered booty to the Muslims in response to this, to try and prevent a complete breaking of the treaty. No doubt, this is what the Meccans feared most. They feared having their sons executed, as it happened to the Banu Qurayzah. They feared that their wives would be raped and sold into sex slavery. They feared being lit on fire. Muhammad's grand plan for Mecca's takeover was kept mostly secret at first. Muhammad intended to assemble and attack the Quraysh using the element of surprise. The Muslim army sent out for Mecca on Wednesday, 29th November 629. Volunteers and contingents from allied tribes joined the Muslim army on the way, swelling its size to about 10,000 strong. This was the largest Muslim force ever assembled as of that time. The army stayed at Maru Uz Zaran, located 10 miles northwest of Mecca. Muhammad ordered every man to light a fire as to make the Meccans overestimate the size of the army. Meanwhile, Abu Sufyan, a leader in Mecca who had battled with Muhammad before, traveled back and forth between Muhammad and Mecca, still trying to reach a settlement in order to avoid conquest. Mecca lies in the Valley of Ibrahim, surrounded by black rugged hills reaching heights of 1,000 feet at some places. There are four entry routes through passes in the hills. These are from the northwest, the southwest, the south, and the northeast. Muhammad divided the Muslim army into four columns, one to advance through each pass. The main column in which Muhammad was present was commanded by Abu al-Jarrah, It was tasked to enter Mecca through the main Medina Road from the northwest near Azakar. Muhammad's cousin commanded the second column and it would enter Mecca from the southwest, through a pass west of Kuta Hill. The column entering from the south, through Kudai, was under the leadership of Muhammad's cousin Ali. The last column, under Khalid, was tasked to enter from the northeast. Their tactic was to advance simultaneously from all sides, targeting a single central objective. This would lead to a dispersion of enemy forces and prevent their concentration of any one front. Another important reason for this tactic was that even if one or two of the attacking columns faced stiff resistance and became unable to break through, then the attack could continue from other flanks. This would also prevent any of the Quraysh from escaping. The Muslim army entered Mecca on Monday, 11th December 629. The entry was peaceful and bloodless on three sectors, except for that of Khalid's column. The hardened anti-Muslims, like Ikrimah and Sufwan, gathered a band of Quraysh fighters and faced Khalid's column. The Quraysh attacked the Muslims with swords and bows, and the Muslims charged their positions. After a short skirmish, the Quraysh gave ground after losing 12 men. The Muslims lost 2. After the battle, the Mecca negotiator Abu Sufyan miraculously saw the light and realized that Muhammad was the messenger of God. But unlike the claim that there is no compulsion in religion, there certainly was in Abu's case. Quote, "Submit and testify that there is no God but Allah, and that Muhammad is the apostle of Allah before you lose your head." After the battle, Muhammad, along with his companions, visited the Kaaba. The idols were broken and their gods were destroyed. Thereupon, Muhammad recited the following verse from the Quran. "Say the truth has come and falsehood gone. Understand, falsehood is bound to vanish." The people assembled at the Kaaba and Muhammad delivered the following address. "There is no God but Allah. He has no associate. He has made good his promise that he held to his bondmen and helped him and defeated all the Confederates. Bear in mind that every claim of privilege, whether that of blood or property, is abolished, except that of the custody of Kaaba and of supplying water to the pilgrims. Bear in mind that anyone who is slain, the blood money is 100 camels. People of Quraysh, surely God has abolished from you all the pride of the time of ignorance and all the pride in your ancestry, because all men are descended from Adam, and Adam was made of clay." Not surprisingly, after Muhammad had shown his ability for conquest and destruction, many converted to Islam shortly afterwards. Muhammad's expansion continued with the Battle of Hunayn. This was the moment when Muhammad, as discussed earlier, got his revelation that it is right to rape unbelieving wives while their husbands were still alive, because you now own these women. After the battle, the Muslims rewarded 6,000 women and children and 24,000 camels. They then went off to besiege the city of Taif, but they lost. Even with catapults and the power of Allah, they were not able to penetrate the fortress. From there, Muhammad and his group of 30,000 took off to northern Saudi Arabia to attack the Byzantine army. At this point, it was revealed to Muhammad that out-and-out conquest was necessary to every area where people were not Islamic until they converted or paid the jizya or tax. In essence, convert, die, or be a slave, also known as modern statism. Quote, "Fight against those who believe not in Allah, nor in the last day, nor forbid that which has been forbidden by Allah and his messenger, and those who acknowledge not the religion of truth among the people of the scripture." Funny enough, with all the 30,000 Muslim men ready to attack the Byzantine army, there were none found. The man who was talking to God sent them to the wrong place. Oddly though, this large expedition brought credit to the Muslim forces in the Arab Peninsula, not only because of how large a force they had, but also due to their ability for conquest. In the aftermath of this flummox, Muhammad sent a letter to Christian princes in the area, which entailed the message, "Believe or else pay tribute. If you do not, trouble will reach you." Trouble did reach them. Mass conversion occurred when men were sick of being forced to pay a tax or die, and this conquesting didn't stop after Muhammad died of a fever in 632. Due to his lack of picking a successor before he passed, civil war ensued shortly afterwards. After Muhammad's death, his successor immediately went to war with former allied tribes which wanted to go their own way. Abu Bakr called them apostates and slaughtered anyone who did not want to remain Muslim. Eventually, he was successful in holding the empire together through blood and violence. The Prophet of Islam's most faithful followers, and even his own family, soon turned on each other as well. There were four caliphs, or leaders, in the first 25 years, each of which was a trusted companion of his. Three of these four were murdered. The third caliph was murdered by those allied with the son of the first caliph. The fourth caliph was murdered in the midst of a conflict with the fifth caliph, who began a 100-year dynasty of excess and debauchery that was brought to an end in a gruesome, widespread bloodbath by descendants of Muhammad's uncle. Muhammad's own daughter, Fatima, and his son-in-law, Ali, who both survived the pagan hardships during the Meccan years safe and sound, did not survive Islam after the death of Muhammad. Fatima died of stress from persecution within 3 months, and Ali was later assassinated by Muslims' rivals. Their son, Muhammad's grandson, was killed in battle with the faction that became today's Sunnis. His people became Shias. The relatives and personal friends of Muhammad were mixed into both warring groups, which then fractured further into hostile subdivisions as Islam expanded. Muslim apologists would like to say that it is impossible for today's terrorists to be Muslim when they kill fellow Muslims would have a very tough time explaining the war between Fatima's followers and Aisha's followers to a knowledgeable audience. Muhammad had explicitly held up both his favorite daughter and his favorite wife as model Muslim women, yet they were invoked respectively by each side in the violent civil war that followed his death. Which one was the Prophet of God so horribly wrong about? Muhammad left his men with instructions to take the battle against Christians, Persians, Jews, and polytheists, which came to include millions of unfortunate Hindus. For the next 4 centuries, Muslim armies steamrolled over unsuspecting neighbors, plundering them of loot and slaves, and forcing the survivors to either convert or pay tribute at the point of a sword. Companions of Muhammad lived to see Islam declare war on every major religion in the known world in just the first few decades following his death, pressing the jihad against Hindus, Christians, Jews, Zoroastrians, and Buddhists. By the time of the Crusades, when it can be thought of that the Europeans finally began fighting back, Muslims had conquered 2/3 of the Christian world by sword, from Syria to Spain and across North Africa. Millions of Christians were enslaved by Muslims and tens of millions of Africans. The African slave boys between the ages of 8 and 12 had their scrotums and penises completely amputated to prevent them from reproducing. About 6 of every 10 boys bled to death during the procedure. The Arab slave trading routes would stay open for 1,300 years until pressure from Christian-based countries forced Islamic nations to declare the practice illegal in theory. To this day, the Muslim world has never apologized for the victims of jihad and slavery, and most likely, they never will. I may choose to further dissect post-Muhammad Islam in further episodes, namely with a more thorough breakdown of the Crusades and the horrendous Muslim slave trade, if the response to this particular episode begins a conversation, rather than people shouting from the rooftops, Islamophobe. I hope you found this useful and educational. I certainly got quite an education just scouring through the sources, stories, and attempting to steer the conversation towards reason, rather than bigoted dogma. Of course, to say that this is the truth about Muhammad would be illegitimate, for I never met the man. But just as all historians do, we go through the information presented to find a narrative that sides with evidence more than propaganda. The moment you begin to understand the history of Islam is the moment you begin to understand why so many people in this world believe so many atrocious ideas. Muhammad was a dictator, a conqueror, a slaveholder, and a pederast. who spoke to himself and called his thoughts godly. Voltaire had an interesting view on Muhammad. I'd like to share a quote from him. "But that a camel merchant should stir up insurrection in his village, that in league with some miserable followers he persuades them that he talks with the angel Gabriel, that he boasts of having been carried to heaven, where he received in part this unintelligible book, each page of which makes common sense shudder, that to pay homage to this book he delivers his country to iron and flame, that he cuts the throats of fathers and kidnaps daughters, that he gives to the defeated the choice of his religion or death, this is assuredly nothing any man can excuse, unless superstition has not extinguished all natural light in him." Thank you for listening. Make sure to subscribe on iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher. If you really enjoyed, give us a rating and possibly donate. I put in a good 100 hours into this presentation, along with a decade of research on the subjects of philosophy, religion, and politics. And all I ask really is for you to ponder the information. If you really like it, share it. This podcast is a bit different than others, in that due to an immense amount of research that it takes and the thoroughness and preciseness by which I choose to present the information, knocking out 3 of these a week is nearly impossible. Without having a guest every episode, having no normal means of getting money, and enough of a cocaine habit to kill most men. But I wouldn't have it any other way. I stand behind everything I say. I believe this conversation is incredibly important, and I admit quickly if I am wrong. So I thank you for your continued listening, even when there's a good amount of time between episodes. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to join the Libertarian Atheist podcast group. Send me some info on Facebook, and also make sure to join the Libertarian Atheist Facebook page. I think we're looking at 20,000 followers there at this point. As always, you can find everything at libertarian-atheist.com. If there are enough substantial criticisms out there of my research, I would gladly do a follow-up episode with clarifications. On that note, have a wonderful day and go out there and be the hero in your own story. Bye-bye, everyone.